Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of The Dunker Spot coming your way. First, similar to our West episode earlier in the week, we cycle through our biggest questions concerning East playoff teams. From there, we shift to the W side. We react to the early stages of WNBA free agency. We've got trades. We've got stars changing hands. We've got some other stars linked to different places. We talk about the latest news and rumors. Stick with us. We're going to have a good time. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are we doing?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. The season is almost over. The playoffs in the play-in are knocking on the door. It's time to continue to talk about hoops. I'm ready to go.
All right, let's have some fun. We're going to talk about some basketball. On Tuesday's show, we went through the top six in the Western Conference and asked some of the biggest questions that we had lingering heading into the playoffs. We're going to do the same thing for the Eastern Conference today before we eventually shift to W News, because, oh boy, things seem to be heating up. But we start in the East, and naturally that means we start with the top-seeded Detroit Pistons, 58-22 as of recording. 10th in offense, 2nd in defense, 3rd in net rating per cleaning the glass. And I'll just say before we actually get into the questions, incredibly funny that like the NBA and the NBA PR account has been tweeting out playoff scenarios all week or like leading into the games. And you look at the Western Conference, like, okay, well, Golden State's locked in at 10 and Phoenix maybe locked in at 7. OKC and San Antonio just got situated. Cool. Then you look at the East and it's like Detroit. That is just it. We know you are the one seed, which is a testament to what they've been able to put together this year and what they've been able to put together recently, as Kate Cunningham just made his return earlier this week, but what they did without him as well. So I just want to salute the Pistons and kind of laugh at how locked in their seeding has been compared to literally everyone else in the Eastern Conference playoffs / play-in picture. So that part's cool. With the Pistons being as good as they've been this year, Steve, I don't think I have a ton of questions surrounding the Detroit Pistons. I would say my big picture 10,000-foot view question remains, but like I feel better about it. And that big picture question to me being, what does the non-Kate Cunningham creation look like? And so like, do I think that is solved and I am just 100% locked in on Pistons half-court offense, particularly without Kate heading into the playoffs? No. Do I feel much better about it than I did maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago? I do. We are 2 weeks removed from having an entire Jalen Duren segment because of what he showcased really all year long, but particularly in this Cade-less stretch where the Pistons go 8-3 with two of those losses being overtime losses to the Thunder and the Hawks. And Jalen Duren just averages an incredibly efficient 22 points per game, gets to the line a bunch. The face-up drives are there. The way that they continue to feed him on some of these elbow touches and he's able to make decisions as a handoff hook, that part's been cool. Danis Jenkins, as he's had to start in Cade's absence, and again, Cade just came back. Yeah, I'm not scared of anything. I don't mind running a ball screen or running some two-man action with Jalen Duren. I can attack in transition. Does get a little shot hunty sometimes, but I can make the reads, I can make the plays, it's fine. With Cade out, they had to lean more into their off-ball movement. More Kevin Huerter. Which, welcome to the rotation, Kevin Huerter, first and foremost, zoom all the way out. But more Kevin Huerter, more Duncan Robinson, that part's been cool. So it's just like, I like that I am seeing more attempts. I like that there are more things it feels like y'all are comfortable getting to. You had to with Cade out. But like, those are seeds that are being planted. But then I also look back and it's like, okay, during that stretch where they go 8-3 and they open up these different looks and you give Jalen Duren more responsibility, open up more off-ball stuff, you do more Danis Jenkins, et cetera. You zoom out, and they were 19th in offense during this span. You zoom out, they were 20th in half-court offense still in this span. And so that's why I can't get all the way to they have answered my questions. I am 100% confident. But I did like most of what I saw. So that is kind of where I'm at with Detroit. Other than that, like I believe in Cade. I believe in Duren largely. I believe in the defense. Them coming out of the East would not surprise me at all. They are the one seed. But like that is the one thing that's still kind of looming as we enter the playoffs.
Now, we're going to talk about your questions. I think it's very interesting. But my number one question was, how many series will the Detroit Pistons have to win before people actually believe? And I'm just very curious as to what the Detroit Pistons have to do to really fully gain respect. Because it feels like everyone's like, well, going to wait for the other shoe to drop. and the other shoe has not dropped. And Cade's been out twice, and they have not been the healthiest team. It has not mattered who's in a Detroit Piston uniform. They're going to play Detroit basketball. My thing mm-hmm. with your question, right, the non-Cade creation, and I have a question, but I'll try and save it, but I think Detroit doesn't necessarily get credit for what they do offensively. Everyone knows their role. Everyone knows their task. And so when we look at this team, Cade has been really good as far as being able to score the basketball, being able to operate in pick and roll. They can attack in transition because they get stops. But are we respecting the tempo that the Pistons play with? Is it a little bit slower than what you would stamp as a good offense in 2026? Yes. But is there movement? Is there purpose? Is there execution? They have the ability to put people in different positions. And so when you talk about, hey, Danis Jenkins is doing this with Cade not on the floor, yeah, he turns into an 89 overall when Cade's not there because, yeah, I'm going to be aggressive. But that's kind of the Pistons ethos. And so when you look at these players, could you be worried about, okay, who can create an advantage outside of Cade? Probably. They may not get a coverage. But are you worried about what they're going to do out there? Do you feel like Tobias Harris doesn't understand his assignment offensively as far as the type of shots he has to make, as far as the type of plays he's involved in, the ways they can use him, slice him in the post? Do you think Duncan Robinson is unaware of his role as far as not only am I going to space the floor, but I'm going to be involved in some of these actions to get a handoff, to create some movement for us? Ditto with Kevin Herter, as you mentioned. Do you think Jalen Duren and Isaiah Stewart don't understand what they're supposed to do? Ron Holland, I'm going to get downhill. Sar Thompson, used everywhere to a degree as far as there's not exactly one thing that I'm doing, but there's a whole lot of stuff I could do, and we're going to move me around the board. So I think that's where it gets interesting for the Pistons offensively. What are you trying to take away outside of Cade becomes the question for me. And, you know, it kind of ties back into something we discussed where it's like, okay, are you in a playoff setting? You're going to put two on the ball against Cade? Does that answer the non-Cade creation question? Because if Cade is creating an advantage basketball for the Detroit Pistons, that's generally a pretty positive thing for them. So how do we balance that out? Is this a team decides, hey, we're going to switch against Detroit and we're going to keep everything flat? And Cade, you got to make a play. Jalen Duren, you got to make a play. I don't think we necessarily respect the flow the Pistons have had offensively. It's not like they're just spamming a certain action. Okay, we run things, didn't work, we drive. And so there's a balancing act as far as what a team would want to take away from Detroit in the playoffs. And so I understand like the concerns of saying, hey, 3-point shooting, how many people can really put the ball on the ground? How tough is this team to truly guard because of the belief they play with?
No, I think that part is fair. And I think the hidden sauce of the Detroit offense and kind of the half court questions you may have, it was true. It's been true season-wide, and it was true during the Cadeless stretch. As you can point to, this is where they rank in half-court offense. And again, that part has never been super high, hence some of the questions coming in. To your earlier point, they are so good defensively, and they're able to force so many misses and force so many stops. The Detroit Pistons, pretty much all year long, have been very low in terms of what percentage of their possessions are actually in the half-court. Like, overall this year, lowest half-court frequency in the league. During the stretch without Cade, that rises up to fourth, but like that's still a top five, or I guess technically lower, you know, bottom five figure in the league. So like they haven't had to solve that problem as much as other teams. And so I'm right there with you in terms of the flow. This is one of the first things we talked about with the Pistons when JB got there. It's like, okay, the Pistons are playing some pretty solid basketball right now. I like their defense quite a bit. This feels like a whole lot of elbow flashes, et cetera. And they have built on that this year. This is where you see, again, the Jalen Duren growth in general. So, like, I love that they do have a level of purpose. And that is, again, something that stood out during this 8-3 stretch without Cade Cunningham. Like, they got two different things. Like, I'm watching this Orlando Magic game. I guess circling back quickly to the Kevin Herter point in particular, because I'm just excited to see him playing basketball for Detroit. But it was fun to see him, like, him in the Duncan Robinson sets. And also, if those were disrupted, ball finds him again. It's pick and rolls. Like, oh, wait a minute. That's Goga Batate at the level. Like, that is a non-Cade person getting two on the ball, and now they're getting to play out of that. They can toss the ball into big at the elbow, get into a split, and they have generated an advantage that way. Like, if they can do that, and they have consistently strong as the year gone on, like, we have things that we can get to, that's where you feel better about it. But now once you get into the playoffs, it's like, okay, to your point, teams may switch a little bit more, be more physical with them. And this is with or without Cade on the floor. And once you get into the postseason, as reductive as it can be, it matters less if you generated good stuff and more like, did the ball go into the basket? And mm-hmm. so, like, I would like to see the Pistons continue to put the ball in the basket. That's where, again, can point to the frequency is low, the sets are good. That's where them being 20th anyway is where it becomes more of a problem once you get here. Because now it is just you have to do it now. Like, the results also have to match the process, which is funny for me to say as generally a process pill person.
Yeah, I'll leave that where it is. But I think it's interesting because I kind of am intrigued because it brings me to my other question as far as what does the defense look like in the playoffs? I think this is a really, really, really good defense. It's a really good team, obviously. But defensively, we know the Detroit Pistons are going to pressure you. They're going to be physical. They're going to make you earn your points. They have size and length. They're willing to rotate and protect the paint. We know everything about what Detroit wants to do to you defensively. And in theory, with a game plan, okay, yeah, we do this as our base, but now we can hone in and take certain things away and kind of just make it tough on you. The question now becomes is, can that scale up in a playoff environment? I think a difficult thing for a defense first team to a degree is the fact that that's your calling card. And if a team is able to poke at it, it has a more of an impact. It feels different because, okay, we are relying on the fact that we can get stops pretty consistently. And now we're in a tough spot because we're getting dinged a little bit to a degree. And so is a team going to be able to find an action that the Pistons struggle with? Is a team going to be able to put Duncan Robinson or Tobias Harris or Kevin Herter or Cade Cunningham in a certain action, keep Asar Thompson out of it, and now, okay, we're forcing your hand to show help that you may not want to. As good as you are defensively, we're going to put you in a position where you are feeling like you have to double or you have to show help, and we can kind of open things up that way. Does a team find a way to poke at Jalen Duren defensively or Isaiah Stewart and say, okay, how do you feel about this action? Are we able to kind of cycle through? Do you want to put two on the ball? Do you want to be in a drop? Do you want to attack things? Can a team wiggle the Pistons' defensive base just enough to make this into a different type of fight is where my mind goes. And that's not saying the Pistons are not able to do things defensively. I think they've been one of the best defensive teams all season. But if I'm on the other side and I put my coffee down at 8:30 in the coaches' meeting, hey, if we can just kind of get them out of sorts a little bit, wiggle this around for 36 minutes, now they're in a different fight in this last quarter. So that's where my mind goes to, can I take what they've done all year to be elite and twist it up a little bit?
You know, this is another example of why I love doing the podcast with you, Steve. Like, the defense and, like, how can we ding this was something that was also on my mind with this group. And I don't believe there's going to be a situation where the Pistons go from top three defense all year long to we get to a playoff setting, they're performing like the 19th best defense in the league. Like, I just don't see that kind of drop off in any individual series. I have been wondering, similar to the Thunder conversation that we had earlier this week, to where JB Bickerstaff has been willing to say, ooh, teams have put a big on Asar Thompson. We don't like that. You come sit next to me. Ooh, Ron Holland, you have missed your first two corner threes and teams are ignoring you. You come sit next to me. Do we get to a place in the playoffs where they're like, okay, I don't know if we can live with this particular problem and what they're doing to the other guys. And that by default dings the level of the defense or lowers the ceiling of what the defense can get to. And then in terms of particular actions, I am keeping an eye on Jalen Duren. Because one of the things where we both acknowledge like how much growth he has shown on the defensive end this year. And so I don't want to take that away. But the one thing that I've kind of been, this is interesting to me. I'm going to put this in the, file this away for a little bit. It's like anytime there's a level of we're running like wedge action or we're getting into like a ram pick and roll, you got to navigate something and then get back and still stay aware with everything else. Those sequences are where I'm like, ooh, this is still an obvious growth area for Jalen Duren. Like, do I think Duren has to execute a late switch? He can do it. Duren in a drop, he can do it. Duren get up to the level and get out, he can do it. When it's, I got to navigate something and then execute my coverage, and then I got to get back low and make sure, like, I got to cleanse. I got to make sure this guy isn't roaming around. When it gets into that, that's where I'm like, ooh, there are still some pockets here for Jalen Duren. And that's where I look at some of these potential play-in matchups or some of these guys that come out to end up being the 8 seed in the East. It's like, there are some fascinating pick-and-roll attacks slash off-ball exchanges, off-ball screening teams that can poke at Jalen Duren in, like, the one way that hasn't been, like, an obvious positive this year. And so I'm glad that you brought that part up, because that is also something I was like, he may have to navigate that. And again, tie back to the perimeter guys, if this becomes, I don't trust that y'all are going to make shots or teams are mucking up the floor, now you don't have your best navigators alongside Jalen Duren, that puts even more strain on him to do things. So, like, that's, I'm glad that you brought that up, good sir. That's a fun one. That is a fun one. Also, one quick note on the Asar Thompson. Can I just say, as we enter Friday night's action, the fact that he is still one eligible game away from being, like, awards eligible is kind of frying me. I would like for him to play at least 20 minutes in one of these next two games so he could just be on the all-defense first team and probably get some, like, French DPOY love and things like that. But I would just like to see that. Somebody in
what's the next team we're supposed to talk about?
All righty, we move to the Boston Celtics, second in the Eastern Conference as of recording, second in offense, sixth in defense, fourth in net rating per cleaning the glass. And for me, this Celtics group has been very good all year long. The major question that I had for them earlier in the year was like, man, will they ever end possessions? And they went from one of the worst rebounding teams in the league through the first month and a half of the year to firmly one of the best defensive rebounding teams on top of what they're doing on the offensive glass. So, like, that has largely been answered. Jason Tatum has come back. Jason Tatum has since recently won Player of the Week. He looks more like himself. Jaylen Brown has been very good all year long. I don't have any questions for Boston either.
Okay.
For me, I start with, if I had to just pick one big picture thing, this is a team that leaves itself susceptible to shot variance. And, like, one thing that's kind of permeated through, like, the Derek White season individually, but with the Celtics as a whole, is, like, with threes off the particular, they are very willing to take them. They almost always win the volume battle. When those pull-ups don't go down, they're not able to set what has been a very good defense as consistently as they can. Now, they have been a good transition defense overall, so I don't want to take that. But just in general, they have been a monster in the half court. They get into different cross-match and they can execute different coverages, things like that. And so, like, my broader question is, like, should we be concerned about the pull-up shooting for them as they enter the playoffs? Because that feels like it can be one of, even looking at previous playoff losses for them, New York, Miami, it's been because they've just been flat out outshot. And they still get to the stuff that they want to, largely. But those shots don't fall, we're losing the variance battle. Like, that's kind of the big, I have minor things that I'm curious about too, but, like, that's kind of the biggest one I have for me, because the pull-up shooting hasn't, for, like, Derek White, from Jason Tatum since he's been back, Jaylen Brown's pull-up shooting started at a really high level, particularly in the mid-range, and that's kind of dwindled as the year's gone on, but he's still, like, good at it. If those shots don't fall and teams switch against them, like, what does that look like? That's kind of the big thing for me right now.
I mean, I think for me with Boston, they've been a very consistent team offensively, defensively. We know what they want to do. Their ability to get the shots for their shot makers, shot takers is ever present. And I think it gets interesting because Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Derek White, Peyton Pritchard are going to drive a lot of those attempts. They're going to have a lot of opportunities to score the basketball. How are they getting those shots? Are they generating quality shots? Are they able to score in transition? What's the balance? So I'm not necessarily as concerned about purely pull-up shooting. I'm wondering what the coverages are going to be. Are teams more willing to switch? Are teams more willing to stay at home? Do teams want to show a double or help? Like, there's an interesting battle as far as the Celtics being able to have pressure points that they can hit. As far as Jaylen Brown, you know he's going to get downhill. Derek White, he can do anything offensively. Jason Tatum, you can use him as a screener. His playmaking has been great since his comeback. You can attack matchups and put teams in a pressure situation, but, you know, can you put yourself in a position where you are able to counter what defenses may throw at you? Becomes interesting because if teams say, hey, we're just going to switch and we're trying to live and we're going to contain, we're going to contest, which player becomes the most important person to take away as far as, hey, let's make Derek White have a tough day. You know, let's if we take Peyton Pritchard off the board, what do they look like? And so I feel like there's a little bit less of margin for error for Boston in the sense that if one of these pieces fall, are you still generating good looks? Are you still able to kind of balance things out in the half court? It gets interesting. And it kind of points me to one of my questions, my concerns, is there a chance that Boston leans a little bit too far into mismatches or matchup hunting or pressure points to where, okay, we've put ourselves in a position where we want this matchup and this is going to be able to generate good looks for us and mm-hmm. we can attack and score, or we can, you know, force help and generate a good three. But is that going to take away from our overall attack? And so that's always mm-hmm. something that's in the back of my brain with Boston. Not that the process is bad, but it's like, mm-hmm. are you going to do this quickly and be able to give yourself a chance to play out of it?
Def, taxes, and Boston Celtics half-court tempo questions. We are so incredibly back. When they didn't do it, we looked at the tempo. When they did do it, we were like, hey, the tempo got a little bit better. I love that we're back here. But no, in all seriousness, like, I think those are all fair points. I guess a question I want to toss to you as we now enter this postseason, what kind of, like, scale down do you anticipate from the Jays in relation to each other as we hit the postseason?
What does that mean?
I think because this has largely been, not trying to do the narrative whose team is it type beat, but it feels like Jason Tatum is getting a larger share of things as he's gotten more comfortable, et cetera. And so, like, do we think it's going to settle into Jason Tatum? Is he's initiating more offense as we get to the postseason now? Do we still see, like, a pretty even split between him and Jaylen Brown? So, again, not doing the bad narrative, but just in general, do we think we get similar usage from Jason Tatum as we saw, like, in last postseason run? Or do you think it's going to be more Jaylen-centric to start and they kind of flow from there?
Well, man, I think it depends on who they play. But I think there's a wave effect that Boston has with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum that allows them both to be aggressive. And with this roster construction, they will have plenty of wiggle room to be able to attack and play off of each other. So that's not a concern for me in this postseason based on what Boston's mm-hmm. done all year and based on the roster Boston has. They need both of them to be good, and they'll both have opportunities to put pressure on teams. So I'm not – that's not like the anxiety point for me. It's more so – honestly, do you have the right lineup combinations? And what bigs do you trust? And how do you want to guard with your bigs? Because just in the back of my brain, I'm thinking, like, and Nene Escada has been great. Vooch, I think, continues to add to them and can help them in certain matchups and certain scenarios. But mm-hmm. you got to remember, Boston is a team that will put a wing on a five, be able to switch everything else, put a big on a non-shooter. Teams are going to counter and put the non-shooter in the action. So what coverages do you want your bigs to hit? Do you have the same amount of versatility defensively with those bigs? Does that put you in a different spot? And so mm-hmm. Joe Mazzulla has done a tremendous job of getting his guys ready to go, getting the effort. But now, okay, if I want to put Vooch in action, does that make you feel a little... If I want to put Nene Escada in action, how many of these is he going to nail? Is that just going to be my pressure point to make you make a decision? And so that's mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, in a playoff series, are you going to be able to hit the right notes? I think that's really important for Boston.
I think that's fair. I think two related questions I have bouncing off what you said there, because the rotation is also kind of permeating for me, because the beauty of this Boston regular season has been we can play a little bit of everyone. They know what their role is. They're going to go 110%. We can get good values, particularly from, like, the rookies, the young wings, et cetera. How much of the young wings do you think we see? Like, how much Ugo do you think we get in the postseason? How much Jordan Walsh do we get in the postseason?
I mean, I think the positive for Joe Mazzulla is all those guys understand the assignment and know what they're supposed to do, and he's willing to play them all so he can shuffle the deck mm-hmm. a little bit. Like, Baylor Shireman's been great on top of what they do. I think the interesting part is, I think when you get to the playoffs, each series is a little bit different for each player. So you may need a piece of, you know, Baylor Shireman's ability to be solid and make shots. You may need Jordan Walsh's just overall versatility and the defense that he brings. You may need Hugo to be active and pressure teams. So I think it's more so tightening the rotation getting the attempt and understanding, okay, this may not be your series. I can pivot elsewhere. So I think Boston has a little bit of an advantage knowing their roster and what they can bring to the table, but it's just going to be fine-tuning it in a pressure situation.
I feel you. Last one I have for you based on the big question that you particular. Do we see a legitimate ramping up of Jason Tatum at the five in this postseason?
I would not be surprised if they mix it in. I think if you're Boston, you want to be in a world where that's something we can go to, but we don't have to go to make this work. That's your ideal scenario. And so we want to be in a situation where we're doing these changes out of a position of strength, if possible, as opposed to complete reaction and, okay, we can only operate playing small. And so that's where it gets very interesting. So I think Boston's ability to do different things defensively, to play small, to have bigs that work, they can throw a lot of things on the table. It's just going to be what matchups, what are we trying to attack, what are we trying to take away, and what does that do for our team?
Okay. I like it. Again, that's pretty much the major stuff that I had on the Boston front. Like, they've been pretty ironclad on both ends. So we can move to the New York Knicks, currently the third seed, 52-28 as of recording, third on offense, ninth on defense, fifth in net rating per cleaning the glass. And I think kind of similar to the Detroit conversation, like, I've had a big picture question that I felt better and worse about at different points of the season. But it starts with Karl-Anthony Towns for me and how often and how consistently they can unlock him, which is why I am glad for, you know, those questions in a vacuum, but also for the purposes of this podcast. We've had Knicks against the Atlanta Hawks, potential playoff opponent, and then the New York Knicks against the Boston Celtics, who could be a second-round matchup if they win their first-round matchup. And getting to see the Cat Brunson two-man game pop the way that it has, and some of the problem solving that's been attached to these two has been, why are you already emoting? Has been fascinating to me, and it has been encouraging to me, because we watched that Hawks-Knicks game earlier this week, and we did the live stream afterward. We talked about a lot of the ways that Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns were unlocked, high pick and rolls, how high they were operating their actions, Cat is a hub, some of the pass and catch or pass and cut between Cat and Brunson. It's like, okay, I like this. We get into the Celtics matchup, and I am thinking, cool, we're going to see Jason Tatum on Cat, we're going to see Nemeas Kata on Josh Hart, and we're going to see how they have to work through this again. And we didn't see that to the same volume, or at least to the volume that I thought we were going to see it. It was sprinkled in a little bit later, or as the game went on. So it's like, okay, this is more Cat being defended by a five. They are getting right back to Cat as a hub, high pick and roll between Brunson and Cat. It's like, I like what I am seeing here, and they're doing so while Josh Hart's still in the starting lineup, to where teams have a very obvious, let's put our center here, point. Can they maintain that consistency in those particular in that particular lineup? Because I think if you're able to fully unlock Cat and thus unlock the Brunson Cat thing, you just feel a lot better about the playoff ceiling of this group offensively.
Here's the thing. I don't think it's about a level of consistency. And I remember a time where you were just putting stats out there about how bad the Jalen Brunson Cat two-man game was. You have to understand, if you're sitting there and wondering, well, why is this all of a sudden working? Why is Mike Brown just running this more now? In these two matchups, they had Karl-Anthony Towns against a center. That is the most important piece. Karl-Anthony Towns against a big is a different Karl-Anthony Towns, because he is now able to unlock things. That big is, unless if they're not switching, which we did not see a ton of in the Hawks and Celtics game, although they mixed it in and Jalen Brunson was able to kind of make the bigs pay it sometimes. Cat now is able to be a roller in pick and roll and force the weak side to help. He's able to pop in pick and roll and make you pay that way with a shot or a drive. He is unlocked. And when he is unlocked, you have more options through the Knicks defense. And so, I mean, the Knicks offense, sorry. But I think if that's the biggest thing between the Brunson Cat two-man game, and that's why the numbers have been so bad, because team said, I don't want to see this. So here is a wing Karl-Anthony Towns. We will switch, and you are going to have to get this out of an elbow touch or a post-up, or you're going to have to space the floor and hope that you go double big and Mitchell Robinson rolls and you get shots out of it. That is the dynamic. And so it's been very interesting this week in particular to watch New York understand the assignment to a degree and see that the Hawks were not going to, like, make the Hawks shuffle through coverages, by the way, because they did do that. between Brunson and Cat. Yeah. We talked about it, but like, hey, we're going to make you try and force this to one side. We're going to make you put two on the ball. We're going to make you be in a drop. We're poking at that. Boston, okay. I expected them to put Tatum on Cat's start. They didn't. They you know, hey, we're going to do a little surveying. We're going to see what you want to do, if you want to attack it. And it was interesting to see Mike Brown be like, oh, that's a big on Cat. Let's tap into this a little bit. And the Knicks have explored just kind of having two screeners near half court. As far as it could be Mitchell Robinson and Cat, it could be Josh Hart and Cat for Jalen Brunson, and just exploring space, and throwing things ahead and letting Jalen Brunson get downhill. If Jalen Brunson gets traditional coverage and Cat gets traditional coverage, it opens things up to a degree. And so how many teams are going to be willing to get that? And are the Knicks going to be intentional with finding a way to get Cat against a big, right? And I think there was an interesting point against Boston where, hey, Boston was kind of back and forth. Do we want Kata? Do we want Tatum on Cat? What do we do? And then we go to, you know, what everyone likes to call ram pick and roll, but like a pin down for Cat into a pick and roll. Boston didn't want to give the switch, but of course, these days, if an offense doesn't want to give a switch, okay, well, we'll just bring the other guy up anyways and get the action we want. And so is Mike Brown going to tap that button to have the counters and be intentional with, I want to get some off-ball movement to get this matchup so now I can get this between Cat and Jalen Brunson? That, to me, feels like the biggest question.
That was a play that I had indexed as I was watching that game back, and it popped immediately. Like, one, I chuckled while it was happening because Jalen Brunson is barking out instructions to Josh Hart, and it felt like Josh Hart just did not hear him for the first 5 seconds of the possession. So just very aggressive pointing and signaling from Jalen Brunson at the beginning of that. But then, as you mentioned already, like, okay, I'm going to screen for Cat. Are we switching this? Are we not? Tatum eventually, then you bring Cat up later, and it turns into high pick and roll. And, like, the other part of this, like, one, I just love that problem solving, though it could have went a little quicker if Josh Hart knew I need to get down there earlier. The pass that Jalen Brunson threw is not a pass that Jalen Brunson throws super often. And I remember early in the year, we were talking about Jalen Brunson against two on the ball in general, and that the Knicks have been pretty intentional about making sure there's someone on the wing for him to give you the early release pass, and that guy can drive or make the pass from there. Jalen Brunson is someone that he's capable of throwing like the weak side skip, but is it something that he does super often? He's also not forcing the issue with like a dart against two into the paint. And so the fact that he hits Josh Hart on that cut from the wing, not with a pocket pass, but with like a legit laser. One, Josh Hart didn't feel like he was ready for that pass. Bobbles it a bit, ultimately gets the layup. But it's like they're doing the good process to get Cat a matchup with a five with some pre-screening. And then Jalen Brunson's also making a read against tendency to unlock something at the end of the clock. And it's like if they can bottle that, doesn't have to make that pass every time because that's just not going to be available every time. But if he's willing to do it, that opens up a little bit more. And if they're willing to do all the stuff that led to that pass, you just feel a lot better. I am intrigued by what that portion is going to look like. Like, I had pick and roll stats. I think it was showing up a little bit earlier at the beginning of April, cited, like, this is what Brunson and Cat are doing against switches in particular, and they were very bad against switches. So, like, that is still something that they're going to have to solve if teams default to, okay, we are just going to put a wing here. That's where, again, more the problem solving to make sure Cat gets a five, or Cat or Brunson just has to punish the switch more than they have been overall so far this year. They're capable, they're skilled enough to do so, but they are going to have to do it. And as I was looking at just some of the general lineup stuff with, oh, go ahead.
No, continue.
Okay. Oh, but no, that's, I was looking at some of the general lineup stuff with Cat, because I posed the question earlier this month. It's like, hey, at what point did the Knicks decide, in light of teams just putting big on Hart, wing on Cat, do we get any kind of lineup tweak heading into the postseason? Or once we get there, are they eventually going to decide, okay, we are starting someone else instead of Josh Hart because of teams just consistently doing this? One, if they perform like they did against Atlanta and some of the problem solvers we saw against Boston, they may not need to, but it is worth noting, per Clean the Glass, there are 38 lineups that have logged at least 300 possessions. The Knicks starting lineup with Hart in, 30th in net rating, not great. You look at the pick and rolls between Cat and Brunson when Hart is on the floor versus when they aren't. The switch rate drops tremendously when Hart is not on the floor because teams can't really afford to put their big on a non-shooter to the same degree. That is still something that I'm monitoring at the very least, but
Before we throw the break, I would just say you got to understand the potential of something to be good, even if statistically it's not going great or it's not having the same amount of success. That lineup is probably the best version of them defensively to a degree if everyone hits the right notes. Offensively, if we can put ourselves in a pressure situation where teams are having to react to what we do, we solve a lot of things. They're going to have to deal with switching. They're going to have to poke at teams. But in this postseason environment, this is where, as an offense, I just need to do enough to get a defense to think that's a bad idea. Let's not do that. And if you're a defense, I just need to do enough to make an offense say, well, we can't attack that. Let's pivot somewhere else. That's the heart of playoff basketball to a degree. It's just the back and forth and the chess game of you don't necessarily feel as comfortable about this, or we figured something out and you now have to solve this problem very quickly.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is very much fair. Good, sir. We're going to take a break there. And when we return, we talk about seeds 4-6 in the Eastern Conference and some of the questions that we have with them heading into the postseason. Stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. We continue our trek through the Eastern Conference playoff standings. We are now at the fourth seed, the Cleveland Cavaliers. So many injuries and roster changes and things, and 51 wins for the Cavs heading into the weekend. 51-29, 7th in offense, 14th in defense, 9th in net rating per cleaning the glass. We did just do a big Cavs episode with a pair of excellent guests last Friday, so check out that full episode to get a full picture of Cleveland Cavaliers' thoughts. But just to kind of bounce off of that conversation and to continue this one, ultimately, biggest question for me surrounding the Cleveland Cavaliers non-health division is simply, will they hit the right lineup notes to make the run that they are capable of? Because we have gotten, I think, 92 minutes of Mitchell, Harden, Mobley, and Allen on the floor together. And they have won those minutes by a lot of points. And I was intrigued earlier this week, they played the Atlanta Hawks, and they pretty much have a fully healthy group. And Dean Wade is the starter at the fifth, is the fifth starter rather. And now that group is plus 30 in 33 minutes together, which is insane. They are shooting 52% from three in those minutes. So like that is going to decline. And teams are not going to shoot as poorly from three as they have so far in those minutes. But a lot of collective size, 3-5, Harden and Mitchell can split the playmaking duties. The sub patterns in that game allowed them to flow into Dean Wade at the four to alleviate some of the backup four concerns and things. And so I was like, okay, this is interesting. And so broadly speaking, like, can they mix and match enough? Because you saw that, you saw Wade at the four, you saw like some Keon Ellis at the four with other guards. It's like, can they mix and match the double big and single big lineups enough and find the right offense defense balance within those lineups to punish this team? From a pure talent perspective, they have enough talent to get out of the Eastern Conference. They have to stay healthy. They have to execute, of course. But how they tap into their lineup versatility and win is going to loom very large over any potential run that they can make.
Again, I would recommend listening to our podcast last week, the Chase Town podcast, as far as breaking down the Cavs. But I think it ties in. You have more lineup versatility to a degree. You have more optionality, which is good for you in the playoffs. Do you over-tinker? Do you know where you want to go? Are you doing this because of what you want to do offensively and defensively? Or are you doing this because what you're trying to take away from a team or reacting to what they do? And so I think that's the curious point about this stretch going down the end of the season is being able to mix in, okay, James Harden's at the four. We have multiple guards out here. We know Sam Merrill can open our playbook. Dean Wade's screen navigation is very important. We can go double big. We can have one big. We can be elite in that territory. We know Dennis Schroeder, Keon Ellis can cause chaos. Jalen Tyson, hopefully you come back. You add to that. Do you have enough of a knowledge of what you have to say, we need this now, this will do this for us, or are you tinkering in the playoffs? It's one thing to tinker and experiment in the regular season, but in the playoffs, you want to have a certain level of certainty or an understanding, I need to accomplish this goal or solve this problem. This lineup will do it for us. So that's going to be an interesting thing for me to watch as far as where do they want to go? How long do they want to stick with different combinations? Because in the Atlanta game, you saw again, like James Harden, we got three other guards. We got one big out there. Okay, let's put James Harden on a big and let's put our big on a non-shooter and let's see what you do with that. So I think a lot of experimentation from Cleveland leads you to questions about them during the stretch, but that could pay off in the playoffs. My mind goes to the bigs to a degree. Jared Allen, that Atlanta game, it was very interesting. He had the mindset, and he's been very good. We talked about it last week, but he's been very good and been very aggressive. But he had the mindset of, like, I would like to dunk every basketball. And when that didn't work, he was like, well, let me get to some of these pump fakes and finish in the middle. They need Jared Allen to be really good offensively and aggressive. They need him to hold up defensively and be able to execute different things. And then for Evan Mobley, he's going to have to be aggressive. He's going to have to be really good defensively. And then when he's going to have to space the floor. And so there are going to be opportunities with Cleveland when you have Donovan Mitchell playing at this level, when you have the brain of James Harden, his ability to bend defenses, there's going to be opportunities where, hey, James Harden draws help. Kick to Donovan Mitchell. That draws help. Kick to whoever's out there. That draws more help. The last pass goes to Evan Mobley. Is that a win for the defense or the offense? So that's likely where I'm at.
Okay. I think that part's fair. One question that I'll sprinkle in that I don't think we touched on a ton in the episode last week. And again, check that out for full Cavs talk. Do you have, I think it's easy to poke at, hey, teams might put Harden in action in some kind of way, which is where the cross match against Atlanta was super interesting to me. And we're going to talk a lot more about that as we get to Atlanta. Do you have any concerns about Donovan Mitchell being put in action as we enter the postseason?
I mean, it's always been a question mark, and it's been something teams have been willing to do against Cleveland. I think having Harden allows them to kind of level the heat to a degree. Because before, when it was Garland and Mitchell, it's like, we're putting both y'all in action. It doesn't matter. One of y'all come here, we're good. If James is big enough to handle a matchup and we take James off the table, does that turn into more Donovan? Does Donovan handle it well and now they decide we can't attack Donovan? Like, I think there's a little bit more of wiggle room for Cleveland because of the size of James and the things they can kind of do.
Okay. Like, I was thinking about that because, like, I think Donovan on the ball has generally been fine, like, even zooming out this past Cavs year, because he's someone that's going to compete shorter guard, but, like, massive wingspan, strong in the chest, all the things. I've been kind of thinking back in my head, like, do we hit the postseason, regardless of who their opponent is, and they're just like, yeah, we're going to poke at Donovan Mitchell by putting you in the weak side corner. We're going to make you make low man decisions. Because if there's one thing that you can poke at with Donovan Mitchell, he can get a little lackadaisical or over-aggressive when making off-ball decisions. Is there a way, to your point about like what they did with Garland and Mitchell, now that we have Harden and Mitchell, you're putting Harden on the big, we get you to switch out, now we have Harden guarding the action, Mitchell's in the weak side, and now it's just traditional pick and roll with Harden having to navigate, plus Mitchell may have to do some stuff. Like, is that somewhere of moving forward is a thought that's kind of been circulating for me. But it's a good team. They're on a run right now. I am fascinated by this. We can move to the Toronto Raptors, Steve, who as of recording, 45-35, 12th in offense, 7th in defense, 11th in net rating per cleaning the glass. I have a lot of questions about the Toronto Raptors. And I think to narrow it down, I kind of starts with the stars. I think there's just a level of productivity that you need from Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram. And boy, did Brandon Ingram light up the Miami Heat last night. And in general, the Raptors just flat out sweeping the Heat during the regular season series when those matchups are always nonsensical between those two, no matter what the personnel is. That's a feather in the cap for the Raptors, and it certainly helps them get closer to solidifying a playoff spot versus a play-in spot. So quick salute there. We are not talking Heat on this pod, thank goodness. I do not have kind thoughts right now. But in relation to the stars and Scottie Barnes in particular, will he find the balance that he needs offensively? And related to that, how can the Raptors ecosystem further unlock him and help him find the balance easier? Because I think the best version of Scottie Barnes offensively is going to be him in transition, either forcing a turnover or grabbing a miss. And now he either gets to push and attack early or somebody else grabs the board. He is streaking down the floor, and he's putting some poor, unsuspecting defender underneath the basket for a quick seal. The half court, it is always kind of oscillated in terms of the effectiveness with him this year. And as he's kind of shifted more on ball as of late, he had the 5-game streak where he had 10 plus assists. But within that, it's like, hey, you are kind of passing up some shots. Some of these drives aren't as aggressive or as fruitful as we are accustomed to. And that's before getting into some of the baked in issues that you have with Scotty as a primary initiator, just handle burst, things like that. And so I'm just kind of wondering what the on ball, off ball balance is going to be for him. What the lineups are going to look like to make sure that you just cannot wall off the paint against Toronto and thus Scotty Barnes and thus limit the effect that is there. And like, what do any of the two player actions between Scotty and Brandon Ingram look like in a postseason setting? Because if you can find enough between those two, now we're coming off of the Boston conversation where you mentioned there's a wave effect to where you can start with Jason Tatum and Florian Brown or vice versa. The Raptors have some elements of that with some of the duck ins and late drives for Scotty and Brandon Ingram on opposite sides. But like in general, I would like to see more synergy between the two in the half court. Because I think if they can score enough, I trust the defense still. But Scotty's role is going to loom very large over whatever potential Toronto has in this play in a playoff setting.
I think it's just, okay, how are defenses going to treat Scotty Barnes and does he make them pay for their decision that they made? I think that's the biggest thing. Can he become someone who has made enough plays to where, okay, I have now posted up this matchup. You got to show help and make a different play, make a different read. I think with Brandon Ingram, there's a comfort with his bucket getting as far as if Brandon Ingram does X, the defense will react to Y. We know that. And so for Toronto, I feel like it's got to be a little bit of everyone has to contribute to a high degree. Emmanuel Quickley has to be someone who is making a defense pay. RJ Barrett has to be a connective piece. The defense has to play at a certain level. Like, I think for Toronto, it's not that they are not a good team. I think they just have less of a wiggle room factor when it comes to a playoff series, and that our defense can't really get hit to a certain degree. We can't have Scotty Barnes playing a non-aggressive. We need the Brandon Ingram scoring. We need Emmanuel Quickley aggressive. We need RJ Barrett driving and making plays. Like, they need certain things to become who they are, as opposed to some of these teams where, okay, if we don't have this, we can pivot to this. It's not that Toronto doesn't have talented players. It's that it's very clear their base relies on all of those guys firing to a certain degree. And so I think with Scotty Barnes, it's just like, okay, it's not that Scotty Barnes is not a talented player. It's that if I'm a defense, switch, make a play, make me think that you will do something else. RJ Barrett, make a play, make me think that you do something else. What's your flow like, Toronto, in the half court after we defend our first option? How are you going to handle that? And then the nights that you are not doing well defensively, what are you going to do about that? That is the balance for Toronto. And so I credit them for the start of the season, figuring things out, climbing back into the playoffs late in the season. But it's now time for you to look in the mirror and do this meme and figure out what you want to do.
Oh, God. You are unserious. I had to say quickly on the Scotty front, and then we can move forward. Like, there has just been, I think, baked into the offensive waxing and waning of his aggressiveness. Some of that is him. Some of that is the personnel around him. Which broader question is just, like, which wings are going to pop in a postseason setting for Toronto? Like, when is the last time we talked about Grady Dick, for example? Like, the spacing in general for Toronto has just been kind of wonky, or teams are just comfortable helping off a lot of guys for them. So, like, who's going to make impact in that wing room? But tied to the aggressiveness waxing going for Scotty is that he has to do so much on the defensive end for them. Guard so many different types of playful, has to extend the pressure as high out. And it's like, you're asking me to pick up 70 feet from the basket, and then on the other end, you want me to put up 20 shots and get to the line seven times and also be our best playmaker. That's not the most fair burden to place on someone. Now, heavy is the hair that wears the crown as, like, the best player on the team, max contract, et cetera. But, like, it's not an easy job that he's having to navigate. So I do, you know, to your point, the defense got to pop, take pressure off of Scotty defensively with some of the lineups and still find enough offense, find enough spacing to where they can get into the flow. Because, like, schematically, Darko has always run good stuff for Toronto. Teams just largely have not cared based on who's been on the floor. So, like, how can they execute enough? How can they find enough to get there? That is where I am at with Toronto. We can now move to the Atlanta Hawks, Steve. Also 45-35, 15th in offense, 8th in defense, 12th in net rating. And I jotted this down as we were watching the game on Monday. And we eventually did like the post game stream. Check that out if you want to get our thoughts there as well. And as I'm watching that game, and as I cycle through like the early Tony Bradley minutes, and then you get into Mo Gay as your backup five, and as you flow later in the week, they still are mostly rocking with Mo Gay as your backup five because Jock Landale got injured and is in a boot. Not sure when we're going to see him return with the ankle injury that he served. Onyeka Okongwu is not Atlanta's best player. I do kind of wonder if he is the most important player to them making any sort of run. One, because of the many things that he can do on both ends of the floor. But tied to that is that when he is not on the floor or if he is not playing well, their options are dire in a way that is kind of uncomfortable if you are projecting the ceiling for Atlanta in a playoff setting. Like, the Hawks have a lot of wings and fours to cycle through, and they have different guards they can cycle through. At the center position specifically, it's Onyeka, and then it's a massive drop-off. And then schematically, it's a massive drop-off in, like, what you can do with those guys compared to what you could do with Onyeka, to where he's been so effective as kind of like a trail option in their offense. They can flow into handoffs, can attack above the break, can knock down above the break threes defensively. You can ask him to defend different types of positions, can switch all over the place. And so is Onyeka kind of the key to them making a run is a question that's been swirling around my head now.
I don't think so. Not that Onyeka Okongwu is not talented, but I think part of that is how willing is Quinn Snyder and his staff to go small and dip into the size of a Jonathan Kuminga, the size of a Zachary Richichet, and have a different optionality to where, okay, Onyeka does this. Maybe we don't have a big, but maybe we can junk things up for a few minutes and feel good about our offensive attack. Are you willing to dip into that bag in the playoffs? That becomes interesting to me. I think the Hawks, it's been a fascinating week for them as far as having the Knicks matchup, having the Cavs matchup. We've seen the good from the Hawks with their pace and their tempo, and they put pressure on you. And they're a team that they're not the Pacers from last year, but boy, they drew some inspiration from them as far as, hey, we're not out of this. We can find a way to get stops. We'll get out and transition and run. And maybe we didn't score for 3 minutes, but we just scored 10 points in 2 minutes. And you got to deal with us. You know what I mean? We're going to get the, you know what I mean? You want to bog us down in the half court? That's fine. What if we're not in the half court? What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about those moments? And so they have kind of an up and down balance where if I'm a team, I want to be physical with them. I want to take away your off-ball movement. I want to make sure you're late in the clock. I want to pressure you. I want to put pressure on you in the half court. And I'm going to attack you on the other end. At the same time, if you're not scoring and they now get a chance to run and you know they will get shots up. So I think as important as Onyeka is, they need CJ McCollum scoring. They need Nikhil Alexander Walker to keep this up. They need Jalen Johnson to be unbothered by how teams treat them and be able to drive and finish. They need the totality of their team to lift everything up.
Mm-hmm. And this has been an interesting week for Jalen Johnson as well, to where you're looking at some of the physicality that he's seeing, some of the switches that he's seeing. I've been encouraged by him, like teams are gapping him when he's spaced on the perimeter. He's taking threes in rhythm. Like, I like that portion of the program. But like, they need the drives from him in the half court. And if teams are comfortable just like sitting on those and helping all elsewhere, that does lower the ceiling of what he can do in these kind of settings, which then bleeds to the offense. And then something that we saw very early on in that Knicks matchup, and we also saw in the Cleveland matchup, like, yeah, we're just going to cross match. We're going to have a big on Dyson Daniels. I have largely liked the way that the Hawks have handled that gambit this year, to be clear. I think they haven't had much issue flowing into Dyson as a hub or a decision maker or just quick pitch, I want to screen for you, and things like that. And again, late in possessions, he can still dart down and get offensive rebounds for you. But boy, did it feel extra audacious this week. And the thing that really caught my eye, particularly in the Cleveland matchup, was like, oh, we're starting to see some of these record scratches from Dyson again, to where he's wide open. He's thinking about, ooh, do I want to shoot this? Do I need to flow? And like that instantaneous nature of making whatever decision it is, that starting to do it, I was like, the Hawks cannot afford to for that to pop back up. It largely hasn't this year, but I saw elements of that this week where I'm just like, ooh, if that goes backwards at all, that further complicates what the Hawks can do in the half court offensively, which is where I've always been kind of keeping an eye on what do they look like against switches. where they look like against physicality to where they aren't just able to kind of get flow based and get everyone involved like the best version of themselves. If you're tossing and cross matching on top of that, and you're also working later in the clock because you're turning down shots, it's been more perilous for them. So I am, I guess, broadly curious about the offense, but again, Onyeka looms pretty large for me in this one. So we'll see what happens with the old Atlanta Hawks. Also, the Orlando Magic at 7 on a win streak, not far behind the Hawks. So things could shift by the time we get to the actual play-in next week. So we will see what happens there. We are going to take a break from here. And when we return, we shift to the W side. We've got trades. We've got trade rumors. We got a breaking news signing as we were recording this pod that we're going to react to. We're going to have some fun on the W side. Stay tuned. Rock with us. And we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot, and it is time to talk about WNBA free agency. So, Steve, we had the qualifying offers and the core things go out on Monday. The negotiation period started on Wednesday. I think contracts can officially be signed heading into the weekend. So we're going to get more news trickling in. But let's react to some stuff that we know so far. Chief among it right now. Because we talked about the Angel Reese trade earlier this week. So check out our video on that if you missed our analysis there. Another trade that seems to be poised to go through. Now, has not been finalized, cannot be finalized until the weekend. We will see if there are any picks or anything else that's going to be added. But in terms of the foundation of the trade, per Annie Costable, formerly of Front Office Sports, she announced her own free agency, but I think we're going to get some news on where she's going soon. So excited about that. Rekia Jackson, you are going to be a Chicago. Ariel Atkins, you are going to be a member of the Los Angeles Sparks. And so, again, we will see if there are going to be any kind of future pick equity added in this deal when we get details over the weekend. But right now, an Ariel Atkins, Rekia Jackson swap in principle. I want to get your thoughts on that, Steve, naturally. But before we get there, how have you kind of soaked in the early portion of free agency in this condensed offseason so far?
For me, I think everyone needs to just slow down a little bit. Have you considered this is absolutely not a regular offseason? We have a massive amount of free agents, right? We have a lot of teams with not just cap space, but a type of cap space they have never had before. We have raises in pay that are well-deserved, but will happen. And now we have to understand who is going to look to get the big money. Am I willing to, quote unquote, sacrifice to play with this team and still get paid a certain amount of money? The dominoes are going to fall, folks. I'm very curious about how these rosters get constructed, how many players want to take short-term deals and roll the dice to compete, to try and win, and then put myself right back in this pot to maybe earn more. How many players are going to get long-term deals where we're building blocks? What does this look like? Because, again, the W is an extremely competitive league. You go back to last year, Nikias, right? How many teams at the start of the season felt like this isn't our year? I have two.
Yeah. Everybody else got to come in two. With the weekend makeup.
I had Connecticut and I had Washington where they were like, hey, this may not be our bag this year. But if Dallas was like, well, we got Paige Beckers. We can get this done. The Sparks got Kelsey Plum. The Sky added Ariel Atkins to Angel Reese. Like there are attempts that will be made in this league, especially as it continues to expand, to put a footprint down. The Golden State Valkyries said, hey, actually, we've built something and we're going to get this done. And so guess what they laid a blueprint for? The fire in the tempo saying, you know what? If we piece this together the right way, we can compete. There's a lot of moving pieces here, and there's not a lot of players or teams that have leverage. And so you're going to get information when leverage arrives and knocks on the door because everyone has options. The teams have plans A through T at this point, considering the amount of players that are potentially available, right? And if you're a player, I got these options to get everything going. So it's like, you got to wait to see which domino falls, which one hits next, how's this go? And then the order of operations are important. Now, to this trade, right? The Sparks have very clearly said we would like to turn this around. They got Kelsey Plum and they said, nope, it's time for us to be extremely serious about this. Now, in a vacuum, Rekia Jackson, I think, was very important for them last year. You can question the fit if you have two bigs plus Rekia at the three. Is Rekia better at the four? What's the shooting look like? That gets interesting. But Rekia was developing into a point where, hey, who's going to guard her to a degree? Because Rekia Jackson can eliminate some matchups, get some post-ups, get some isolations, and make things hard. If you're the Chicago Sky, and I want to circle back to some of your thoughts, because I remember you were like, hey, I'm not going to be kind to the Sky in the postseason. And now we're like the Sky offseason eye emoji with the monocle. And I'm like, interesting. But if I'm Chicago, do we understand potentially the process of losing a young star in Angel Reese while in our back pocket, we're getting what we think is a young star in Rekia Jackson that may alter our fit around our other young star, Camila Cardoso? And can we now build this in a little bit of a different way? I just think the concept is interesting as far as how these teams believe they can achieve the next step.
Where to begin? So I think on the spark side of this, I echo your sentiments. It has been very clear, you know, stemming from the Kelsey Plum trade into this trade now, like, we are not looking to slow play this. We are not looking to be patient. I remember when we had initial conversation surrounding the Kelsey Plum trade to the Sparks, where I was a little bit more like, ooh, do you really want to give up a top two pick to do this when you are not really in position to just flat out contend right now? Like, adding KP felt like a move because she is an all-W talent, a champion, etc. Like, this is a final piece type move to me, not necessarily what it was for them. And you, you noted, I don't know if teams can afford to be patient in the same way with the way that the league is building, with the way that you can turn things around more quickly, the arms race that we're seeing with building facilities and being able to pitch folks and, like, entering the CBA and this massive free agency. You want to make sure that you have stuff in your organization that you can pitch to people to help accelerate your build, et cetera. But, like, okay, like, I understand the logic. And so now they are continuing to build or stay on this road. You add Ariel Atkins into the mix. The logic holds for me. And I think if you are building out around Kelsey Plum, and we're going to get to the big signing that the Los Angeles Sparks are bringing or bringing back into the fold in a little bit, Ariel Atkins makes sense as someone that can handle some secondary playmaking ability, that can knock down shots, doesn't need the ball to be effective. And for a Sparks defense that had its moments of perking up, particularly in the second half of the season, it was not a very good defense overall. Ariel Atkins, who is not tasked with being your de facto number one option or primary ball handler, can return to, if not all defense levels, at least close enough to where this is a very clear upgrade to anything that we have in the building right now. So I think the on-court fit, obviously depending how else the Sparks plan to build this roster out, it makes a lot of sense. It makes sense for their timeline. It makes sense for, like, the stars they have in the building. It's cool. You are really running the risk of accelerating this because you started with number two pick plus Rekia Jackson plus Cam Brink. That flows into Rekia Jackson and Cam Brink. It is now just Cam Brink. And, like, depending on how you feel about Sarah Ashley Barker, obviously was not protected in the expansion draft. She's gone too. So, like, it is now just Cam and Saniya Fagan. And so we'll see what kind of role that she has with them. But it's like, hey, man, like, if you are pushing into this degree, and I understand the logic behind it, and I understand the Ariel Atkins fit, if you are pushing into this degree, you have to be successful to an extent. Because if we enter this next season and the Sparks are, like, seventh, then it's like, hey, what have we actually built here? And what did we punt on in the pursuit of building in this way?
I think for one in the W, you got to respect the attempts that teams make to say, hey, I think this will work. Let's world out. And win or lose, we tried something. Like, I think sometimes we get so built into quote-unquote cap space or quote-unquote draft capital, and we think that we can build in a linear fashion, which, it, you know, has its value. But a lot of teams will be like, you know what? Swing the bat. Let's see if we get a home run. I think with Ariel Atkins in Los Angeles, it's a wild dynamic to a degree, because on one hand, you are willing to roll the dice on the same bet the Sky made last year. But at the same time, Ariel Atkins next to Kelsey Plum, next to Cam Brink, next to mystery player we'll talk about here shortly. boy, that's a fit as far as I can play on ball, I can play off ball, I can help you with your lineup versatility, I can defend, I can shoot from three, I can create plays. And so you have a player that may feel like a more natural fit versus a young player in Rekia Jackson, who's got a boatload of potential and was impactful for you. And it runs counter to how teams kind of run things, where it's like, young player can get better, let's scale this up. Well, we don't have to pigeonhole what Rekia does and make sure that she's good, or wait for the three-point shot to hit, or try and, you know, open up minutes at the four. It gets interesting as far as like trying to build a roster conceptually. And I think like it's a massive bet on how much they love Ariel Atkins, who's a very good player. Like I feel like that Sky season shouldn't erase how impactful Ariel Atkins can be. This is like an all-star caliber player that we've seen produce at a high level for many years. But Rekia Jackson has the ability to, well, if this three-point shot starts to go down and certain types of players can't guard her, that's a whole problem. And so you see just two type of dynamics opposing each other to a degree. So I'm Chicago, absolutely. Give me Rekia Jackson and let's see what we can do going forward. I'm the Sparks. Love Rekia, but give me Ariel Atkins into this vacuum that we're building. It's interesting. It's very interesting.
No, it's interesting indeed. And I think it's important to index, as you mentioned, the Sparks kind of making a similar bet to the Sky did. Worth emphasizing, like, hey, we are making the veteran swing while we already have a star in Kelsey Plum in the building. As opposed to the Sky, who Angel Reese was your best player. Was she, you know, not an all W player, at least not yet? And so that's where, you know, we talked about it in real time. I was like, I understand wanting to speed this up. I am not giving up number three pick to do this unless I am getting like legitimate star. So you have that in. And so like the context being slightly different is where it makes more sense from a fit perspective. Like we already got a baked in number one in Kelsey Plum. Now I was anticipating we're going to have Kelsey Plum and De'Erica Hamby that you're adding to this. They have found a different four. It would appear. Ooh. So we will see what else happens on that front. Yeah, buddy. But like either way, you're still looking at star guard, star four. Now we can add Ariel into this to have like this real spine of, you know, one, two, or two, three plus a four. We have that baked in. As we shift to the Sky portion of this, I am fascinated by this because you make the Ariel Atkins trade, and I was like, that feels steep, but whatever. You core Ariel Atkins because I'm not making that trade and then just letting her walk for nothing. And now it is looking like it is going to be a signing trade for Ariel Atkins, which if you're a core and you sign with that team, like you can get up to a one-year deal worth of Supermax. If you are signed and traded, you are capped at the regular max, a little bit over 1.1 mil. And so this being the signed trade to the Sparks means that this is going to be like pretty much at a million or lower, depending on what they negotiate with Ariel. So like salary-wise, might not be as steep for the Sparks. But turning that into interesting young player in Rekia Jackson, who is also just on a rookie scale contract, it's where like, okay, cool. We have turned veteran into younger player with more upside, with more wiggle room to make more swings in free agency. And I think Chicago has some fun stuff coming. So we'll see. We'll leave that there. And it's like, okay, this is how you bounce back with some of the asset management or mismanagement that we've seen. As you alluded to with me, where I was like, I'm not going to be very kind to the Sky on the podcast. I'm kind of looking at the totality of this with Marina trade into Ariel trade into Angel trade, in which you only got two first. I feel better where you have the Rekia move in back pocket, but they still very much have work to do. And even as I kind of project what this can look like, as much as I can anyway, because they still have to fill out the roster, I am intrigued by Rekia plus Camilla and what that could be offensively. I am a little concerned about what Rekia plus Camilla defensively right now. This is where I want to see how they round out the rest of the roster, what their overall scheme is going to be, things like that. The basketball has to be played. But I'm just like, okay, it's a talent play, it's an upside play. There are some fit questions that need to be answered here and some more work needs to be done overall. But I think just in general, Rekia is such a fascinating offensive player. With, as you mentioned, the way she can drive, the way that she can hunt mismatches. Like, if you're able to bottle up the second half that we saw from Rekia Jackson, where she's getting some of these post touches sprinkled in, she's more comfortable taking threes off the bounce, Steve, per Second Spectrum, shot 35.5% on off the dribble threes last season. I was like, hey, wait a minute. If the three-point shot is not even elite, if it is just a compliment to what she can do inside the arc and what that can mean for some of the mismatch hunting. And I said this on a thread on Twitter, people were asking me about it. I'm intrigued by Rekia being able to score all over the board, Camila Cardoso being able to be having her passing ability tapped into a little bit more, using her above the break as kind of a passing hub. The screening has to be better, but the passing ability is there. We can invert the floor and let Rekia go to work. She could take some of the scoring load off of Camila to where you can allow her to develop more as a post threat, as a finisher. Because like that's kind of the quiet thing with Camila right now. She has the size and the touch. The footwork and the fluidity on some of these interior touches has to get better. And so now if you got Rekia to take some of that pressure off, and now you're just cleaning stuff up or just getting some late duck-ins and drawing fouls, it's like a much easier context for her to kind of grow. So I'm fascinated. I want to see what else Chicago does. For me, as of recording, I like this a little bit more for the Sparks than I do for the Sky. But that, again, is pending on what else the Sky do to round this out.
I mean, just conceptually, without knowing how the entire roster will be built out. And again, we got to wait for dominoes to fall. But I like it for both sides to a degree. You know, we talked about the Sparks portion, but I think for the Sky, the name of the game is freedom to a degree and a context that fits people differently. And so if I'm having Camila Cardoso, you can now do all the five things to a degree, in theory, depending on who they have. But we're not tied to we have two bigs. We're going to have to try and figure. No. You do what you do. And you now add a young player in Rekia Jackson. You have the freedom, you do what you do. So I think that's a win for Chicago as far as, okay, are we betting on being able to unlock these two young players in a different way? And if I'm the Sparks, are we able to kind of just build a context that we have a lot of talent and you got to deal with us? Because they're really trying to shake things up, guys.
Yes, they are. And speaking of shakeup, Steve, we naturally had a spotlight on the Seattle Storm and what this offseason was going to be for them. Heading into the expansion draft, like, ooh, are they doing the shenanigans with NECA where you don't have to protect her because she's not core eligible, et cetera, and then we can protect some other players? Are we protecting Brittany Sykes versus Ezzy Magbegor? What are we going to do with Gabby Williams? What's going on with Skylar Dick? Like, a whole lot of stuff. The one thing that we know right now is that Neko Gumake is not going to be there because she is going home. She's going home. Tell the WNBA world that she's going home. Back to the Los Angeles Sparks is Neko Gumake. As announced by her sister, Shanae Gumake. Can't get much better than that in terms of sourcing goes. But Neko's back with the Sparks. And so now you're looking at a star-level duo in Kelsey Plum and Neko Gumake. Plus what Ariel Atkins can slide in, how she can slide in as, again, secondary creator, shooter, strong defender, etc. That is a fascinating big three in Los Angeles, but it also sparks bigger questions for me. As you have Kelsey Plum and Ariel Atkins in the backcourt, is that just your starting backcourt, or do you want another point guard next to Kelsey Plum? Because if you remember during that second half run for the Sparks last season, a lot of that was Julie Aleman at point guard, shifting KP off ball. And like she was just a plus minus monster for her, for the Sparks. Aleman was no longer there. Do you want another point guard next to KP, whether to start or just to kind of slide into those lineups? And that naturally slides everyone down a peg. But now with NECA being there, and we're also obviously going to get into like how good she is, et cetera, what does that mean for the rest of the front court free agents? Because like I already had some doubts about Azrae Stevens returning to the Sparks in light of wanting to turn things over to Cam Ring, et cetera. If NECA is there, I find it hard to believe that De'Erica Hamby is also going to be there. And De'Erica Hamby coming off an all-star / fringe all-W season in her own right. I am fascinated to see what happens with those two over the next few days. But we'll stick with NECA for now. Steve, how do you feel about the NECA fit in Los Angeles?
Well, we've seen what NECA brings to the Sparks over the years, and they pivoted, and now NECA's back with what they've rebuilt. Hey, we got Kelsey Plum. We got Cam Brink. We potentially have Errol Atkins. It gets very interesting. And I think a lot of times for a team, you have a skill set or you have a performance and it's like, okay, this is really good for us as a base. What if we pivot and add more to it or get a different player? And so if you're talking about what De'Erica did for the Sparks and what Azrae Stevens did for the Sparks, you had double big lineups that worked. You had people that could scale up to the five. But if now we're now bringing back Nneka Nwumike into a context he's very familiar with and the ability to just punish teams offensively, to be active defensively, it raises your level to a degree. So I think for the Sparks, that's where you understand why we would try and get Errol Atkins, because we have the chance to get Nneka. And if we can tie these two things together, we're a different team. And like that's where it's like, I understand we're wanting to run and sprint and understand teams are changing and shifting in real time. And a lot of these moves are complementary to each other to a degree. But I think, you know, Nneka and Cam Brink defensively together.
Yes.
What would you like to do? What would you like to do with that? That's not easy to deal with, and that insulates Kelsey Plum. And then if you add Errol Atkins to that, we got perimeter defense, we got bigs. You know, if we can bring Ray Burrell back, we have things that we can do to elevate what we built on last year. So I think that's where you have the veteran presence of Nneka, who we know can contribute and make teams pay on both ends of the floor. And for the Sparks, you have to look at that and be like, yeah, We're knocking on some doors this year. Last year was cool, but you know we need to get it up.
It's time to get even better. I wanted to start with the defense, so I'm glad that you eventually flowed into that, because Nneka plus Cam Brink is such a fun pairing. So one quick salute to Nneka, just saying like I am always going to have a high level rim protector next to me. Thank you. When I go to Seattle, hey, that is Ezzy Batmagor. We had Balloon Gate in Minnesota that could have been, you know, Fee when she's healthy. Alanna Smith when she comes back. But, you know, rumors that Alanna Smith's going to be elsewhere. So we'll get there when we get to the rumor section. Oh, back in L.A., I got Cam Brink. I'm cool. I am going to be a four. And I can slide down to the five in some lineups. But I got some shot blocking next to me. That is self-preservation. That's understanding the assignment. So that's fire. But I am excited about that. And I think the overall infrastructure point is a very important one. Because I think if you get more per possession consistency for Ray Burrell, like she obviously has the tools to be a very good on-ball defender. We just talked about what Errol Atkins can do defensively, and her off-ball work in particular is very good. Cam Brink plus Nneka, like, regardless of how you feel about Kelsey Plum defensively, if you think she is bad defensively, I do not. But if you think she's bad defensively, that should be four positives around her that you can insulate her with. When you factor in, like, KP does not mind extending ball pressure. And, like, if you're telling her, hey, we're keeping these pick and rolls down the sideline, like, she can very well do that. She's willing to take charges, et cetera. So, like, she also brings her own value. I just appreciate the Sparks overall just being like, hey, so what we were last year is never going to happen again defensively. We are not going to be this defensively. And, like, I think as I was thinking through, like, the Nneka versus the Erica stuff, that's the biggest difference between the two. Because De'Erica felt like she finished everything last year. She was incredibly good. But like De'Erica as a defender versus Nneka as a defender, like that, there is a gap between the two, with all due respect. And so like, if you're able to find more balance holistically with this group, you feel better about the Sparks winning games based on that. You just have more wiggle room. You have a higher floor, because we feel like we are going to have a level of chaos defensively, especially if it's still going to be, as we saw in Seattle, Nneka at the level, hedging out and just bothering folks. If she gets to do that while Cam Brink can mix that in or mix in some late switches or just kind of roam, ooh boy, you get navigators in front of those two, ooh boy. And then offensively, Nneka's still a very profound screen threat, pick or pop threat, or pick and roll or pick and pop threat. Can obviously post up. I keep an eye on like what the aggression is going to be for her at times. Like, you have the capability of scoring 25 whenever you want to. Sometimes she just didn't seem like she wants to. Playing alongside Kelsey Plum, I don't think she's going to feel that same pressure to get buckets all the time. This can very much be KP does not have it on this night, or KP is seeing two on the ball tonight. It is my turn to score 23 points on 70% shooting. And so I love this context for her. And, like, obviously the backdrop of her returning to where she spent the first, 12 seasons of her career, won her MVP, won a championship, all the things. Like, that also adds a level of fun to the signing, but just from an on-court fit, it just makes sense for both sides. Which, again, brings me to, where's De'Erica going? Where's Azaray going? For Seattle, Skylar Diggins has been linked to a couple of teams that are not the Seattle Storm. Where is Skylar Diggins going? Hey, man, I feel like we're going to get some really interesting unrestricted free agent decisions over the next few days, if not the next few hours, if not the next few minutes. I'm fascinated by the rumors.
I'm telling you, sit and let the dominoes fall. Let these teams piece these things together. What do we have next, Nikias?
Oh, dear. Actually, can I toss you a quick free throw before we get to the next trade?
Absolutely.
What do you think is the best spot for Skylar Diggins if she does not return to Seattle?
I would probably counter with, is there a bad spot for Skylar Diggins? I think with her skill set and her competitive nature and what she can bring to a team on both ends of the floor, is there a place where Skylar Diggins doesn't fit? That's where it gets interesting to me. Because, okay, do I elevate, quote-unquote, the Chicago Sky? Do I join a different team to bring what I do to what you've already done? Again, this is where construction gets interesting. Because what does a player want to do? What is a team trying to accomplish? I don't know if there's anywhere in this league that Skylar doesn't fit outside of maybe a couple of the teams that are missing some pieces to elevate. But even then, do we put Skylar in a position where she can elevate a base? I don't know that Skylar would want to do that at this stage. But at the same time, she's got the talent level to produce anywhere she goes.
Yeah, I think on-court fit, to your point, she could fit just about anywhere. I'm just like, what's the ideal landing spot here? Because, like, my first thought was always like, hey, Minnesota, if we want to upgrade the point guard spot, where you have been so close to winning a championship, does Skylar take us over the edge? As you mentioned, like, she's been linked to Chicago, so we'll see if that is a thing that happens, which, oh boy, fascinating group if she ends up going to Chicago. But we will see what happens there. The other trade that we have right now, more of a cap-clearing move, but still intriguing for me, the Connecticut Sun and the Dallas Wings agreeing to a deal. The Sun receiving Diamond Miller, who was a member of the Dallas Wings via the DJ Carrington trade that happened a bit of last season. And Raya Marshall coming to the Dallas Wings. And I say salary clearing because Raya Marshall on rookie scale contract, unprotected deal. So the Wings could technically waive Raya Marshall and just get immediate salary relief. And if that is a move that comes through the pipeline soon, what does that indicate about what Dallas wants to do in free agency? What kind of swings could we see them make and how they want to add around Paige Bueckers? I am fascinated with the Dallas of it all. I guess related to Dallas. Shout out Christina Williams, who reported Awat Kuir coming back to the Dallas Wings, coming back to the W. So excited to see how she slots in. And just in general with the Wings, like how any of the big moves do or do not influence what they're actually going to do on Monday in Monday's draft. So we'll see what happens on that front. But I think the Raya Marshall portion is easier to talk about. But like, how do you feel about Diamond Miller in Connecticut? Do you like the swing there from the Sun?
Yes, I'm intrigued. I'm very interested. Let's see if Diamond Miller can really find home, right? I think the Minnesota Lynx being like, Diamond Miller, you were excellent. Come with us. And then their whole context changing immediately put Diamond Miller in a tough spot as far as, hey, philosophically, we've changed a whole lot of what we do. And we're going to have skill and size and shooting on the court at all times. So it's not necessarily going to be like you need to fit into a vacuum more as opposed to do what you do. We saw the trade. We saw flashes of Diamond Miller producing in Dallas. Can this be the context to where Diamond Miller can just kind of reset in Connecticut going into Houston and show what she can do on both ends of the floor and just have the ability and the context to open things up? And that's where it gets interesting. Because if you're Connecticut, right, we lost Marina Mabry. We're in on youth. We have young players. We have cost control to a degree. We're building this up. But if we now have comfort with our young bigs and we add a young piece in Diamond Miller, so I understand, you know, the rookie scale contract scales up, but if we are now able to kind of have this type of player producing at this type of level, we feel good about what we can build and what we could present to free agents. You know, to the earlier point we talked about, we've got to build something up to be able to knock on doors and be like, would you like to join what we've done? And so I think it's an opportunity for Connecticut to have a young player. It's an opportunity for Diamond Miller to just kind of be like, okay, I'm going to have a chance to play in a way that maybe I haven't. Like, even with the Dallas trade, it's a mid-season trade. So we've already got stuff that we're doing, and we have Paige Beckers, and we have Arike. So you, again, have to fit into a context. Is this a spot where Diamond Miller can now showcase the driving ability? Can she grow defensively? Can she produce at the level that we've seen her do before in a place that feels like home? Fit, context, opportunity, so important in basketball. So we'll see if that's what occurs for Diamond. But I think if you're Dallas, it's like, we got something up our sleeve. In case we don't, like, we got a very good big, but, like, we saved some money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think to the portion, I'm intrigued to see, like, how Connecticut chooses to deploy her. I think, like, collective athleticism of Layla Lacan, Saniya Rivers, Diamond Miller intrigues me. The collective shooting between those three gives me some pause. So, like, I don't know how often we see those three on the floor together. But I think for me, because you've hit on most of the major points, I'm not going to hang here too long. One, I just want Diamond Miller to have a healthy campaign heading into the season. As simple and reductive as that may be, I just want her to get through the full 40 or 44, etc. Beyond that, how many advantages can she create as a driver? How many opportunities will she have to attack tilted defenses within what Connecticut wants to do offensively? And even to the defensive portion, like, it's going to be attentiveness more for me than anything, particularly off the ball. But, like, on ball, like, she has the traits to be a good defender. We've seen flashes of good on-ball defense, versatile defense. Connecticut was quietly one of the more aggressive pick-and-roll defenses that we saw in the league last year, which also begs the question, hey, so what's Tina Charles doing? Is she coming back? Are they going to stick with two on the ball there? I'm curious to see what happens on that front with Connecticut. But, like, if you have an aggressive defensive infrastructure with a really strong point of attack defender on top of that, and Saniya Rivers can defend a little bit everywhere, depending on how often we, again, see those three on the floor together, like, that feels like an easier infrastructure for Diver to kind of slot into defensively. And if you get enough stops, force enough turnovers, you unleash Diver in transition. Like, that is where she is at her best. And so I like this for her, lower stakes environment in an infrastructure that should help her. And for the Sun, like, you're doing this with, you know, this one guarantee. Like, this is the last year of the Diamond Miller contract. Protected deal, but last year. If it doesn't work for whatever reason, okay, that is fine. The cost to bring her in was someone that was behind three or four other bigs on the depth chart. So it's very much like a no-risk, moderately high-reward kind of move. And for Dallas, again, you either add Ryan Marshall into your system and see how much of the defense we saw at USC can we unlock in some spot minutes, especially, you know, they lost Luisa Geisel-Solder during the expansion draft. We'll see what they do with the front court or not do with the front court in the draft. Like, are there some spot minutes here to week we can tap into some defensive aggressiveness or more aggressive schemes with her? If not, we waive her, we have more cap space, we splurge around Paige, and we truly try to build this thing out. So I think it's a deal that made sense for both teams.
So, Nikias, if I could ask a question, is the biggest domino to a degree what Satu Sabally wants to do? Because Satu said, Phoenix, appreciate you, I'm out. Where does she land? What does that elevate? Like, obviously, it's going to change the mercury, but, like, hey, do we go to Toronto? Do we go to Portland? Do we go to a different team? Is Satu the piece that's going to make things shake to a degree?
I would say so. Like, it was fascinating as we got into some of the core decisions. There was a lot of angst among Aces fans. It was like, hey, what do you mean there was no core designation used on Jackie Young? And you go to Phoenix, it's like, hey, what do you mean there was no core designation used on Alyssa Thomas or Satu Sabally? And then once you get one early reporting that, hey, Satu might not be there, it's like, well, hold on. And then Satu posts the Instagram post, and it's like, oh, she's actually just not going to be there. Why did y'all not core Satu Sabally? Because the way that you acquired Satu Sabally was because the Dallas Wings knew she was leaving and they cored her so they could trade her? Why did you not do that? So I'm curious, like, how that portion broke out. But yeah, like, I am fascinated. I mean, there was I think her sister is in Toronto. There was a Drake song as part of the IG post with her detailing her goodbye. And so, like, if you want to read tea leaves, like, that seems to be the front runner at the very least, I would assume. But a lot of different spaces for no shot. A lot of different places that Stop 2 could slide in. Like, again, Toronto makes sense. Portland makes sense if she just wants to be a number one somewhere. A question that I would toss your way, Steve. How would you feel about Satu in Golden State? Because that's the landing spot that's kind of hit me in a headlock.
It's an interesting concept because Golden State essentially did what they were supposed to do as far as we've built something, we're pretty good, come hang with us. And it's like, well, got a lot of options. So Satu would be the type of player that would take them over the top with her ability, obviously defensively, I think underrated defender to a degree at some times, but like, okay, I can elevate us in the half court. We can do a lot of different things with what I can do. You can move me around the board. It'd probably be the most intriguing location, but who knows what Satu wants to do. I just know whatever team she lands on, probably going to feel a lot better about their prospects.
I'm right there with you. So we'll see what happens with Satu. We'll see what happens with Skylar Diggins. Like, quiet as kept. Do we need to keep an eye on Melissa Thomas?
I am intrigued by the Mercury. They built a lot up in Satu being like, yeah, that was cool. I'm out. Doesn't like, not in a messy way, but it's like, well, that was a big piece of what you had with this big three. Can you replicate that? Or again, the Mercury hit on the margins last year. Do we do that? Empower Alyssa Thomas, empower Ka, and just try and become a stronger team overall.
Mm-hmm. Like, Alyssa Thomas just gives you a really high floor, assuming she's healthy. So like, they may not miss Satu as much in their regular season, depending on how they build this out. Postseason, in terms of the ceiling, that we will, again, we'll just have to see how they build that out. In terms of actual confirmed news right now, quick shout out to Jackie Young and the Las Vegas Aces. Jackie Young signing a one-year deal at the regular max, so a little under $1.2 million. She is officially the first $1 million player in WNBA history. So salute to her. Kirsten Bell also re-signing with the Aces, signing her restricted qualifying offer at the minimum. So Kirsten Bell back, Jackie Young back. I would assume we are going to get Asia Wilson and Chelsea Gray announcements over the next few days returning, but we will see what happens there and what the salary figures look like on that front. To the New York Liberty, Steve. On the rumor mill, they've been linked to Atlanta Smith, one of the teams that has checked in on the availability of Atlanta Smith. That would be fascinating to add that level of defender to that kind of infrastructure. So we'll see what happens there. But in terms of official news, Marina Yohannes expected to be back with the New York Liberty. I would imagine that makes you happy. Is that what we're on? Oh, dear. So as we get into some of the core designations that were announced on Monday and then later came through the pipeline on Tuesday, Ariel Atkins, as mentioned, going to be signed and traded to the Los Angeles Sparks. So no max money for her. And in general, with the core designation, like, you do have to sign that to get the max money. These things can be negotiated down for a multi-year deal, less money, etc. But your core candidates, Bridget Carlton with the Portland Fire, Nafisa Collier in Minnesota, Alicia Gray in Atlanta, Kelsey Plum with the Sparks, Sabrina Ionescu with the Liberty, Marina Mabry with the Toronto Tempo, Ezzie Mattbegor was the core designation choice for the Seattle Storm, Kelsey Mitchell with the Fever, and Arike Ogunbowale with the Dallas Wings. And in terms of reserved qualifying offers that have been accepted, some notable names there from both the expansion teams for the Fire, Emily Inksler, Chloe Bibby, Maya Caldwell. For the Tempo, Lexi Hale, Nikolila Milic, Lee Yeru, a big name, figuratively and literally, with the Dallas Wings as well, and a few others that are under contract now. So we're starting to see the rosters fill out a little bit, but this is setting the stage for contracts being able to be officially signed on Saturday. And just a lot of big names still out there, Steve. I think last free throw question I have for you. Who's an underrated free agent name that you're still keeping track of? May not be a star-level name, but someone that could legit swing something for a team with where they sign.
Who's not? What name's not underrated? Everyone's a free agent. What you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man. Everyone can get a deal. Let's go.
That's crap. To answer my own question, I'm curious to see, especially in light of recent moves, what does Elizabeth Williams do? Is she back in Chicago, or does she take her defense and screening elsewhere? Could be a stealth starting quality big that could also cycle in as like sixth woman in a role on a contender. So I'm curious to see what happens with Elizabeth Williams. We're talking non-all-stars. There we go. There we have it. And thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel and the Yahoo Sports YouTube channel. If you have not already, you can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we got a fun weekend ahead. NBA basketball. We got the W draft coming up. We got more free agency stuff. We got a lot to react to next week. Enjoy your weekend, friends.